Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Phidias Club. This is episode 129 for what month is it? May, of course, because we're getting EU elections for May 2019. My name is Patrick Beja, and today we're going to be talking about all manners of world-ending events for your dismay and enjoyment. I'm from France, originally. I currently am residing in Finland, but I also have people from other countries in the world. Notably, I'm going to start with Tom, all the way in California. How's it going, Tom?
I am doing well. Thank you for having me, Patrick. It's always a pleasure to be on the Phidias Club.
Thank you so much for waking up ungodlily early for being with us.
It's near the time that I normally wake up, so it's not even a problem.
Ah, well, thank you anyway for that little extra or a little less sleep that you're willing to endure. And we are very glad to be welcoming again Gareth from the UK, who he is, as we were joking about before the show started recording, the brave soul who came on the show as a proponent of Brexit. So thank you for being back.
No, it's good to be back. Thank you for having me. And it's a pleasure to be on again.
I'm glad that your experience wasn't so disastrous that you decided never again. So thanks for that.
No problem, no.
So today we're going to be talking about a number of things. We're going to be mentioning Brexit, of course, how things are going, which has been making the news in France. We're going to be talking about EU elections, of course, which are somewhat linked to Brexit. And then there are a couple of other stories, one about a person called Vincent Lambert in France who has been hospitalized. He's been brain dead for a few years, and a massive legal and other manners of battles have been waged about his fate, which is really not fun, but has been making a lot of headlines in the past few weeks. And then I guess, Tom, we're going to be talking a little bit about abortion as well.
Which is equally... Yes, don't sugarcoat it. No, we're going to be talking, of course, probably people are somewhat aware that the state of Alabama in the United States passed a very strict anti-abortion law.
Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about that. And to finish on a slightly brighter note, apparently you can't smoke anywhere in Beverly Hills anymore, almost.
It's hard to find a place where it's legal to smoke in Beverly Hills, but if you're Arnold Schwarzenegger, you can do it.
So we're going to be looking forward to that as we sift through the world-ending controversies that are making the news in Europe, at least. We'll see if it also does in the U.S., although the U.S. has its own topics to tackle. But let's start, as I mentioned, with Gareth. Essentially, Theresa May has finally imploded, I guess is the best way I can put it, according to the French press. But more widely, how is Brexit going? We don't have to spend, an hour on that, but...
No, I mean, I think...
That's not a simple question to answer, Patrick.
Well, I'm not sure. It might be a simple question because it might just be, go back and watch the previous episode or listen to the previous episode I was on, because honestly, I'm not completely convinced that anything has really changed. We've got extensions upon extensions. We still don't really know what's going on. I think the press in the UK, it's difficult to necessarily know who to believe. We've got another couple of parties that have, political parties that have appeared out of the woodwork who may or may not be helping to resolve the situation. It's all still really just a bit of a mess, and I don't really think anybody knows what's going on, frankly.
I'm hearing that Boris Johnson is possibly even likely going to be taking the head of the party after Theresa May allegedly resigns even tomorrow, right?
I still think we've yet to see whether she does actually stand down. I know there've been various things saying that she's said she's going to, and the House has not given dates and times and things, but I probably should know this, it being my country, but I'm not 100% sure how the election of the new head of the party goes.
Let's say she does resign, and Johnson takes the party and I guess becomes prime minister, or at least leads the party. What are your feelings about her resignation? I know she's basically popular with no one in the entire country, is my feeling. And Johnson is, to say the least, a controversial figure. But as someone who's on the camp of UK should leave the EU, what do you think of both of those potential events?
Yeah, I mean, I think, unfortunately, Theresa May, I think, has ended up with a really, really bad name. And I don't necessarily think that's completely her fault. She was, as we said on the previous show, the British public wanted a talking monkey, and
it turns out
there is
task.
No talking monkey. Yeah. She had an impossible task to do. She has attempted to do it and has failed, which, let's be honest, is not particularly surprising. She's ended up with a bad name, and she's ended up with, as you say, everybody hating her because she's tried to walk down the middle and she's tried to make everyone happy, and that hasn't worked. So it's a shame, I think, that she hasn't, or that she's not going to be able to see the situation through, and maybe resign after Brexit had been sorted. But it looks like that's what's going to have to happen. And with regards, Boris Johnson coming in, again, he's had some really, really bad press. I mean, I've seen him in a couple of the, comedy TV programs that he's been on, or the current affairs things. And he sort of seems to be quite plain talking, which I quite like, but then also seems to be lying and deceiving people and not necessarily being completely completely straight, which clearly, is not good. But he is pro-Brexit, so I guess if I take the hard line stand, which might not be exactly where my mind is at anymore, but if I take the hard line stance, he will be a good prime minister because he will get the job done, I think, at the expense of half of the population of the country.
No matter what job gets done, it's going to be at the expense of half of the population. It just depends which half. So you think it might be possible for him to get it done? Because, as you said, it's half the population, so won't he face the same kind of opposition from the other half, but from both halves, because some say the deals that May has proposed don't go far enough, and the others say that it goes too far, and I guess the situation would be reversed. I don't see how he could. Maybe he can do something, but you expect he might?
I expect he's going to try, but I think Theresa May has been trying to walk more down the centre, and I wonder whether maybe if Johnson comes in and is more harder line, that might if he goes one way as opposed to trying to walk down the middle, that might get sufficient people to vote for what he's suggesting, and it might just get it across the line.
If I may, I feel like the two main issues with Brexit are the Irish border and the fact that the European Union has said this is the deal. We're not changing it. What we can tweak the political declaration, but otherwise we are not going back to the bargaining table. I don't know how anyone who isn't Theresa May gets around either of those. At least I haven't heard anybody suggest a credible way that they could solve this problem, which is why you see Theresa May continually saying, oh, here's the same thing in Helvetica. Here's the same thing with some gold leaf. Like, oh, you don't like it now, but it's the same thing every time.
That's the conversation we've been having for, what, a year now? And we keep coming back to it because, you know, as you reminded, Gareth, the promise was a talking monkey. Like, for people who hadn't listened to that episode, we were saying someone was promising a literal talking monkey. They were saying, yes, we can get a talking monkey. And when the talking monkey isn't produced, because talking monkeys don't exist, there's a problem. And I guess it's what you were saying, Tom. The Irish border and the deal that the EU is proposing are probably not going to change. So I guess, how does it work? I guess it's more likely than a hard Brexit is going to be the deal. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're voting today for the EU elections and not wanting to necessarily, you know, move on to that yet, I guess. But I guess it's all part of a very similar thing. But, you know, I'm sat looking at the list of parties that I can vote for. And I'm thinking, I've got UKIP, but UKIP really, they sound like they're quite nationalist and quite racist, and I don't really want to be voting for them. Brexit Party is led by Nigel Farage. I don't want to be voting for him. All of the rest of the parties are basically then going back for another referendum to try and get a different answer from the public,
right?
And I don't necessarily think that's what we ought to be doing either. You know, I am kind of the opinion that we had a referendum, the country voted, it was a slim margin, but it was a margin. We should stick by that. I don't think we should be allowed to then go back for another referendum just because it's proven difficult.
Well, I guess difficult is understating it a little bit. But I see what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. But. You know, having said that, I'm a realist, and if, as I say, if there is no talking monkey, surprise, surprise, we can't have one. So actually, the decision, you know, a lot of people made their decision about whether they wanted Brexit based on what it transpires to be a complete lie. Mm. So if we did have another vote, I'm fairly sure it would go the other way, and I suspect it would go the other way by a significant amount.
Mm. Would you be for a hard Brexit? I wonder.
I think I would be, although I have to be a little bit careful because several of my customers would have significant problems if we did. So that could cause me some trouble as well. In fact, just saying that out loud might get me in trouble. But I think if that's the decision that was made, you know, if the answer is we either come to an agreement or we just come out with no deal, then I think that's what should have happened. Mm. But I think it's been messed around with now for so long that maybe that's, you know, maybe people ought to be given a second chance to vote on it.
All right. Well, I mean, yeah, I'm sure, as we always say about Brexit, this is going to be a continuing conversation. We'll see what happens in the next few days. The very much related topic is the EU elections, which, against all odds, the UK is voting for. Which I have to add, apparently it's a public holiday for you guys on voting day. Which I'm looking at the US there as I'm saying this, but
Patrick, the farmers.
Right, of course,
they must go to market.
Yeah, no, we don't have it's not a public holiday quite, but because we use lots of the primary schools, so the schools where we've got the little ones, they use those as polling stations. So they close the schools for the day. So it does end up being that lots of parents have to have the day off to have their kids, and lots of the schools are closed.
So you have to use one of your days off.
Yes.
Right. So it's not a public holiday at all.
See, how it's many, not just us.
Wait. How many days off do you get a year?
I've been self-employed for so long that I don't really know. I think the minimum is 20, and then we have 8 public bank holidays.
Right. So minimum 20. There, I get you back, Tom.
Gareth gave us the solution is just be self-employed. A free market will allow you to set your own days off.
Yeah. I apologize for that.
I had 4 days, I think.
4 days. That's nice. Okay. So EU elections. So the UK, because of all the delays, is voting in an election to get a parliamentary, how do you call the people who get voted in? Not parlementaires in
MEPs.
French.
MEPs, members of the European Parliament.
So MEPs in the European Parliament, in which they will, if all goes well, but we never know, they will officiate for just a few weeks or months. How is that going?
Well, I think most of the population are wandering around sort of with shrugging, with a bit of a, what's the point? If we are going to be coming out of Europe in the next couple of weeks, which by rights we should be, then we are spending a whole lot of time and money and effort to elect people that will then just, come home and not have that position anymore. And if we do stay in, I kind of get the feeling that most people are going to be voting based on the organisation's or the party's Brexit stance. So that might not actually be the best stance for the country going forward if we remain in Europe. We should probably be looking at the full manifestos and trying to work out what people are actually standing for. But nobody's going to get past Brexit.
It really annoys me that we can't. I'm always struck by this in this show. But it annoys me so much that we can't have these kinds of conversations in other, outlets. Because we are talking about things that we disagree on vehemently, but you're making a lot of sense. And when I talk to you, I hear someone who is completely coherent. And that is an image that is so different from the one. Anyway, sorry. It's just.
Thank you. I'm not completely sure that I think I sound coherent sometimes, but if I sound coherent from the outside, that's good news. People get polarized, don't they? They people get upset, and people generally, as I said last time round, I've listened to Patrick, your podcasts, in the past. I know that you're sensible and you will listen, and you're not just going to jump down people's throats and start shouting. So that's why I'm happy to be here talking about it, really. So, and I'm hoping that I'm being similar.
Well, yes, absolutely. It doesn't mean I don't, that's a thought I had. This feels, the EU elections and Brexit feels like things that would devolve into wars in a different time. Trying to see the positive aspect of it. And if it was a war, I think we would be fighting each other, Gareth. Like, we would be meeting on the battlefield, and I would try to do some Captain America move and fall on my face and probably die in the first 5 minutes. But this is the kind of thing that could lead to wars between nations, which, ironically, have been avoided for the past 50 years or more because we've had a European Union.
You're assuming there that you're Captain America. What, can I not be Captain America?
We can all be Captain America. Tom won't disagree. But yeah, in this EU election, it's been. Sorry, Tom, did you want to add something?
No, I was just suggesting Captain Britain as a role. Carry on.
Oh, there is a Captain Britain. Unfortunately, there isn't a Captain France, not a Marvel one anyway.
Capitan.
Yeah, he would probably be, the dude fighting with baguettes and stuff, wearing a beret. We have Super Marcel or something like that in France, which is, of course, a big joke. That's not what I mean. I want French Captain America. That would work. But yeah, these elections, even in France, have very much become a kind of a different fight, but it's a fight that has been happening for a few decades now. A fight between the quote-unquote regular parties and the far right parties. In essence, it's the EU-friendly parties and the nationalist parties. And the main one is, of course, the Front National that has been essentially transformed into the Rassemblement National. And this time, more than ever, this is becoming a referendum between do we like the EU or not? And of course, in this EUism versus nationalism fight, nationalism doesn't get a majority, but it's the question of which party will get the most, the highest percentage. And currently, both the party in power in France, in government, the République En Marche, and the Rassemblement National, so Marine Le Pen's party, are neck and neck at about, I believe, 20% of votes, something like that. And the others are a little bit below to very much below. And it seems the vibe we've been getting in the media is that this is the fight that has been happening in Europe, I think deservedly so, has been happening in Europe for the past, a long time, but very starkly for the past 5 to 10 years. And nationalism has been rising in all of Europe, different spots here and there. But Brexit is one example of it. And you have other countries that have far-right nationalist governments all through Europe. And of course, there are many in France who are saying from the left side of the political spectrum, many are saying the issue is that capitalism needs to be reined in because it's serving a part of the population, but some are being forgotten. And this is the voices we're seeing expressed in the movements like Brexit and Trump's election and the what's happening now. And if only you had, I want to make sure I convey this part of the French narrative, because I think the people listening would be angry at me if I didn't, because it's an important voice. And they're saying if we didn't let capitalism, of course, most of them would probably agree, for all their rhetoric, they would probably agree that capitalism is the model we need to follow, but it needs to be reined in much more aggressively than it is now in order to serve the people who are being left behind. So this is one of the voices that's being heard, and Macron's party, the president, so the République En Marche, is an example of not being tough enough on capitalism and capital gains. And anything left of the Socialist Party, which, again, socialism means a lot of different things throughout the world. In France, socialism is not communism. It's just social democracy, essentially. But even social democracy is, to the people who are defending this point of view, a little bit too much to the right. So anyway, make of it what you will. I personally don't really agree. I think the issue is that nationalism is promising talking monkeys and making issues of things that are not as problematic as they make it out to be, and they're scapegoating things that are not responsible. But that's, you know, my opinion. Obviously, a lot of people, Gareth included, are think that it is indeed the lack of agency and the issue of immigration and many others are significant, and that they should be fought through possibly leaving the EU. So I'm not quite sure that the Rassemblement National is advocating for leaving the EU outright. I don't think that's the case. This is something that is not as popular, but it has other controversial stances that are being discussed and frightening a lot of people who are not. Because again, remember, they're very strong, but they are strong because they are 20%, maybe the largest party in the country, but it is very, very unlikely that they would get any sort of majority in a general election. It's just that they get in the relative ones, they might be the biggest party. So anyway, this is the sense we're getting now in France, and I think it resonates throughout Europe. It's a bit scary, to be honest. I personally, I don't even know how I'm going to vote. I'm going to go back to France to vote in a few days. And to me, the big issue is climate change, which, again, I'm sure, you know, the people voting for the nationalist parties probably don't have a lot of concern about. But I end up having, and I'll finish on that, I end up having to weigh two different issues. Which one is the most pressing? Is potentially damaging our relationship with the European Union, which is to me a cataclysmic issue, because I was joking about peace earlier, but I really do think that this was a huge, one of the many, many advantages that the EU brought us, versus the cataclysmic, maybe cataclysmic is a bit overemphasizing it, but the very serious damages that climate change could be doing over the next few years and couple of decades if it's not reined in. So I don't know if I should vote for the government or just to stop the nationalist party, which, yeah, or vote green. So I don't know. I'm lost and a little bit afraid. And that's where I stand.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you say that, because the Economist BBC coverage that I have been viewing has presented the climate in Europe as trending more towards union and less about separation, which is a very different perspective than what you're painting right now.
Yeah, it's not at all what I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. It's, even if the Rassemblement National, the far-right party, is, as I was saying, not necessarily advocating for a Frexit anymore, mm-hmm. that bit them in the last presidential election, they are definitely nationalist, and they would want to go in that direction rather than the opposite. So at least in France, and maybe it's a function of the context of our election, but we're hearing about all of the other countries in Europe where this is also happening, and about the growing tensions between Macron and Merkel, who, you know, don't see so much eye to eye anymore, and all of these things, which essentially the headline could be EU in peril. And that would, you know, I might even make it the title of this episode, because that's how it feels like.
Do you think that the Brexit situation is making that worse? You know, is it worse or better? Maybe initially it was, oh, look, you know, if the UK can get out, then maybe we, you know, other countries should as well. But maybe they're now looking at the situation and saying, ah, well, maybe the UK can't get out. Maybe this isn't possible.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't think it's helping. But at the same time, I think the EU wanted to make sure, not in a malicious way, but didn't want to make it easy for the UK, right? It wasn't going to throw the UK a party for that decision. And I guess it did bring a little bit of pause to other nationalist parties in the union. But I wouldn't say, it doesn't feel, at least from what I'm hearing and seeing, it doesn't feel like they are all of a sudden saying, oh, well, it can be done, so let's not even discuss it anymore. There are still people who are saying it, you know, arguing about all the things that have been argued about in the UK. So I couldn't tell you. I think overall it's probably a net positive, because it the disaster of Brexit is showing that it's not as easy as some people might have made it think. But it's still not. It didn't quell. It didn't quell that fire. Is that a phrase? It will be.
Quell, yeah.
Well, yeah, quell the fire, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting.
The opposite of Billy Joel.
Yeah, we did start the fire, sorry. I was looking at, there's a website that I've been having a little look at, which is mepranking.eu, where I have no idea how they give the rankings, but they rank every member of the European Parliament. And as I'm just looking at the map, I just see this big gap in the middle, which is Switzerland. And I guess that's part of my logic was, well, you know, Switzerland are managing absolutely fine. Could we not be in that situation? And I think that's where a lot of my logic kind of goes.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on Switzerland, but I think they have a lot of they have a lot of regulations that put them in line with things that happen in Europe, in the EU. I just recently read that they had to change gun regulation, actually, to...
Voters voted in favor of harmonizing gun regulations with the EU, which was a surprise to me.
It was a surprise to me as well. But I think overall, of course, it is still a little bit different, but it still has, if it wants to work with the EU, it still has to, you know, it's one, I think, of the situations that the people who were against Brexit were saying the UK might fall in, which is to an extent, maybe not exactly, but to an extent, still have to abide by some of the regulations of the EU without having the agency that it currently has or did have. Maybe we should ask our Swiss friends for an assessment.
Yeah, I think the other thing is that, you know, not everybody is quite as polarized as the press would make out. You know, my opinion, as you know, as we discussed, is that I think we should leave Europe. It probably still is that. But I don't necessarily think that means we should leave Europe. We should go back to the old British wiring schemes, and we should change the, you know, the train track sizes. And you know, I'm not advocating let's completely, you know, close the tunnel. You know, let's not be silly.
But that's, you know, that is what is frustrating.
Undo currency reform.
That's what's frustrating in that debate, is that the UK already has the, and let's not rehash everything every time we talk about this, but you realize the UK already has a pretty sweet deal with the EU, where it has to abide by the least amount of, you know, regulations and agreements of all of the EU, right? So I don't know. I'm sure there might be, you know, a situation where it would be even less and still work with the EU. But I don't see what the better situation would be, unless you close the border, in which case then you're indeed not in the EU, and it's that... you can't have it both ways, right? If you close the border, then you have more agency on your border control, but then you don't have free trade and you don't have free movement of people. And then that doesn't solve the problem you're trying to solve if you don't do those. That's, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. So have you been hearing about the EU elections, Tom? You mentioned that the BBC was making it sound... like it was all roses and butterflies.
I think it was more The Economist that was presenting that part of it. But maybe they were just focusing on the fact that these nationalist parties are no longer pushing Nexit and Frexit and sort of moving back towards the center. But yeah, I'm always...
I think what's his name, Thierry something, actually pushed Nexit yesterday or the day before in a debate, which was, yeah, anyway...
Yeah,
it's Netherlands exit, for those who don't know.
I like the idea of it just being the next country to design. Right. But yeah, I've been seeing a lot about the EU elections through the BBC and on the Economist podcast that I listen to, for sure.
I guess this is...
On Politico and The Hill, no, not so much.
Right, that's what I was going to get.
I don't see it in the LA Times.
The Americans don't care about good old... I guess they have enough to worry about with China already, with what's happening there.
Yeah, has Trump suggested that America should leave Europe or not? I mean,
I wouldn't be shocked.
All right, the other topic that has been very actively discussed in France has been the... I should mention there's another thing that has been making the headlines. It's the summons of a few journalists for their investigation, the summons from the police of a few journalists for their investigations into controversies and scandals by the government, many including issues in war zones and stuff like that. And it's been kind of a big I can't find the English word. People have been, especially in media, have been very unhappy about this because it kind of stifles the freedom of the press to an extent, or it's at least very concerning. And it's after the voting of counterterrorism laws from a few months or a couple of years back. And I don't know enough. It's really breaking now, and I haven't really investigated that too much, so I'm not going to dive into the explanation, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention it because it's been quite a big deal over the past couple of days. But the other big story was the Vincent Lambert issue. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Vincent Lambert is a young man who's been in the hospital and after an injury. I think he was a fisherman, but he's been brain dead for a number of years. And his case, essentially, the problem is his parents are very fervent Christians, I believe. I mean, regardless, they would like him to be kept alive. And his wife and other family members think that he shouldn't. Allegedly, he said that he didn't want to be kept alive if he became vegetative, in a vegetative state. And but he didn't put it in writing. And so his case has been in the courts for a long time, and recently the courts ended up deciding that he should be taken off life support, but then because of a regulation in the UN, I think, the court ordered, according to the opposite party in the case, under pressure, ordered that he be kept alive like a few hours after they were making the preparations for taking him off life support. So the case itself is obviously pretty upsetting and pretty tragic. But around it, the whole debate about whether or not life support should be ended has reignited and taken the country... the country has been taking it at heart in a way that I didn't expect it would. And I mentioned that the parents are fervent Christians. I don't think it's quite as relevant as some people hearing this in the U.S. might think. Of course, it's a factor, but it's really a philosophical debate, I think, in France. And I don't know that the country is divided right down the middle. It probably isn't. But the debate in this case in particular is especially difficult because it's the parents versus the spouse. And there's bitterness and anger, of course, and sorrow for that poor man who's being kept in life support. And you know, sorrow because either he deserves to be kept on life support, according to some, and the others are threatening to take him off, or the opposite. He's suffering, and he's being put through that suffering because of someone else's beliefs. So this is the topic that has been discussed, and it's been very, very active. I think overall, if I want to characterize the mood around it, it's not a mood of vehement arguments and angry debate. It's more the mood of, except for the parties directly involved, of course, it's more a mood of, holy crap, this is such a difficult question. What do we do? Right? It's half hands off, not hands off. Like, it's not our place to decide for the people involved, but we are looking at it in dismay and thinking, maybe I'm projecting my opinion, but I think the country is more looking at it in as I was saying, dismay and thinking, I don't know that I have the right answer.
Well, yeah, and it does make me seriously consider drawing up a living will, because that would have helped. It may not have solved it, but it would have helped if there was clarity on exactly what his wishes were. But since
I think it would have solved it.
Nothing written down.
Yeah, I think it would have solved it. If he had, then the court would very easily execute
sure.
his will.
You still might have some families objecting sure. and all of that, but you would have clarity around his issues, around his wishes, and I think that would have helped quite a bit. It's when you don't know for sure what he really wanted. Exactly. Then it's up to the family. And if the family doesn't agree, well, the, there isn't a clearly agreed upon right or wrong in that situation.
No, I mean, I guess you would assume that the wife would be the, in the UK, we use the term next of kin. I don't know whether that translates well, Patrick, or not, but, you know, so, as far as I'm aware, you know, my wife, if I was in that position, would make that call. I, you know, my parents, I'm sure, would have an opinion, but they would go with what my wife said.
That's the heart of the discussion here as well. And I guess that there is some legal argument why she is not being the one to make that decision. I'm not exactly sure what it is. Maybe there is proof that from the parents that he used to think. Maybe there's a document that says, you know, I don't want to be taken off life support because of his religious beliefs in the past. And maybe he had, according to his wife, he had, I'm just making stuff up now, but I'm wondering if that's not the case. He had strayed from that and decided that he didn't want that anymore. But I'm thinking that might be part of the legal battle. And there certainly is a very complicated legal battle around it. So I can't imagine it's just, you know, oh, this person is responsible and then that's it.
Yeah, maybe part of the lesson to learn, if you know, to take a lesson away from it, would be to say, actually, it might be a good idea to have some, whilst they might be difficult, but some open conversations with your close family about, even if you don't officially write a living will, you know, don't get the lawyers and solicitors involved, but to at least make sure that, you know, over dinner at some point you say, right, just so you all know, this is what I'd like to happen.
I wonder if a tweet counts.
Maybe.
There have been some cases where tweets were or were not accepted in court cases. Yeah, that's interesting.
You know, it's really difficult for me as well because I don't know what I would want. It's if you're just quote unquote asleep and we don't know that the person is suffering for sure, I don't think. And if you're not, I mean, if you're in a vegetative state, it is extraordinarily, ridiculously unlikely. It's like, you know, a chance, and we can't conceptualize how unlikely it is that things will reverse. Essentially, it's impossible. And so, but if you're not feeling anything, I guess what's the harm in keeping you alive? I don't know. Maybe there are studies that shows you do feel.
There have been recent studies that have found indications of consciousness in people that were thought to be otherwise brain dead. It's just a limitation of our knowledge and our ability to know what's really going on and what consciousness actually is and whether those activities are just, you know, fluctuations or whether they indicate some kind of awareness. So it's such well, a gray area because you can't know for sure. But like you say, it's highly improbable that he is going to recover or that he knows what's going on.
And that makes it even more difficult. Because let's say there is some shred of consciousness in there. Does that mean that you are constantly semi-aware that you are, you know, you can't move or do anything? Or and you know, that is even worse. So that becomes, should you, you know, interrupt care as mercy indeed, as some, you know, that is a form of suffering, I'm guessing. I don't know. I don't. That's why it's such a complicated issue. No one has the answer, I suppose.
No, and I think that the other thing is that you have to consider that if somebody did make a recovery, what would that recovery look like? You know, would that recovery actually be in a position where you have a quality of life that you would like to have going forward?
I guess you know, if you have enough of a recovery, then, you know, there are people who are heavily handicapped and who live their lives and who might be not satisfied, is the wrong word, but who would be, of course, much very glad that they are able to live that life. But if you do make a recovery, at least you can express your desire, you know, so that then that becomes a different conversation. But I don't know. But yeah, so all of this made me, the children are home, I guess.
The children are shouting.
They're saying, Dad, you have to go vote. It's important to vote. Don't, forget, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think that they're saying, Dad, we've just kicked the ball over the fence. Can you go and get it back, actually? So,
I feel very bad keeping you from your children, keeping you from being a dad. I apologize.
No, they can find some sticks to play with or something. It'll be fine.
But right, so that discussion kind of echoes a little bit what I've been hearing. Well, I mean, it seems that the discussion, jump right into it. It seems that the discussion about abortion is a lot more, I think the first word that comes to my mind is vicious in the US, and maybe that's not the right word, but it's the one that echoes in my mind when I think about it.
Yeah, it's strident. It is a very strident debate. It's a litmus test for many people who have supported the current president, despite disliking many things about him, because they feel he will push forward on right to life. And that is something that we have now seen with a couple of judicial nominations on the Supreme Court. Now the state of Alabama has passed a law that will outlaw nearly all abortions in the state if the law is upheld, which I'll get to that is a big if. The new law makes it a crime for doctors to perform abortions at every stage of a woman's pregnancy. Now, critical here is that it does not punish the woman, it punishes the doctor. It includes an exception for cases when the mother's life is at serious risk, but it does not include exceptions for rape or incest. This is going to be challenged in court. It is likely, because of the precedent of Roe versus Wade, not to pass muster. The question is, can they get it to the Supreme Court, or if other states pass similar laws, which are under consideration in a few other states, could they then gather those together to convince the Supreme Court to rule on it? And if so, would the current Supreme Court decide to overturn Roe versus Wade, or would it not? That's what this is all about.
I think we all know Roe versus Wade is the decision that made abortion legal in the U.S. on a federal level. What was the case? Do you know? Or maybe it doesn't even matter.
Man, you asked me these questions. I could have prepared.
Okay, it doesn't really matter, to be honest.
It's a right to privacy that protects a woman's right to choose whether or not to have an abortion. It was
privacy. Wow.
Okay. Yeah, it does hinge on that.
Okay, that's interesting.
And the right is not absolute and must be balanced against government interest in protecting health, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm. Wow. So it's essentially a right-wing argument, I suppose, if you have to classify it in that way.
I feel like I have not given you enough information to make that statement.
Right. I don't know. I hear privacy and government not interfering in your affairs, and I think right wing, but yeah, that's the short. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not necessarily the case. So when you say doctors can't perform abortions at any stage, it means, like, even in theory, 5 days, you can't.
Correct. That under this Alabama law, that right. would be the case. Again, this law is not going to be enforced, at least not at this stage. It's going to be challenged in court, and it is highly unlikely, given Roe versus Wade as a precedent, that it would not be found unconstitutional, or I guess not be found invalid at this point. But
it's on hold.
Yeah. Well, no one expects it to hold up to court scrutiny the first time around. This is part of a longer battle. Pro-life advocates know that they have to do this a few more times to get it to the Supreme Court. The reason this hasn't happened before is there was no hope that the Supreme Court would overturn Roe versus Wade in the past. And so the attempt has always been to chip away and find just how far you can chip away at the precedent of Roe versus Wade. But now that they feel that there's a chance the Supreme Court might overturn, there's a bolder move, and Alabama's is the first step in that.
So
is there an amount of religion involved in this as well? It's with it being the Southern states, I mean, from an outsider's standpoint, that religion seems to be quite a big thing the further south in the US you go.
I don't know if that's true. That is certainly the stereotype. I think it has more to do with conservatism that to get it passed than it does with just religion. There are many religious people in the North who are pro-life, and there are many religious people in the South who are pro-choice. But there certainly is the cultural stage in Alabama for this to be more favorable because of the elected officials. And the body that passed this is, you know, the people who voted for it were entirely men, and I believe mostly, if not entirely, white men.
Would you expect people who are not religious to be pro-life?
Yeah.
I guess in the U.S., most people are religious. It's rare to have non.
Well, actually, no. Most people are not religious in the
That's
United
true.
States.
That's true.
It's just a large number and a vocal number that are religious. And the United States has a religious heritage, too. So even the non-religious tend to respect, in the middle ground anyway, religious beliefs. A lot of time there's a lot of people, a lot of fence sitters in the United States, to be honest. And
I will add that from personal experience, there are a lot of people who are not religious who fear saying they're not religious.
Mm-hmm. I mean about that sort of respect. It's sort of like, well, I'm not religious, but I'm not going to make a big deal about it. Whereas if you're religious, a lot of people don't want to make a big deal about that either. It depends on whether you're reading something online or talking in person. Talking in person, people don't really like to bring up religion with each other.
Well, so I'm very curious. Sorry, Gareth, I'll give you the talking stick again in a second, but I find it hard to believe, and that might be my bias and the image I have of the U.S., that this could be characterized as a non-religious issue, Tom. And I know
that is absolutely the case. The abortion rights debate is very much along religious lines. It is not to say that there aren't pro-life people that aren't religious, or vice versa. I think what I was trying to say is, just because it's the South isn't why this has momentum. There are laws on being proposed in northern states as well, but there is more of a cultural of conservatism in Alabama, which is, I think, why this got through their legislature first.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking that one of the things that we say quite a lot in the UK is that if you don't want to get into a fight, you should not talk politics or religion. Given the amount of politics we've already had, I just thought it was worth throwing religion into the mix.
Yeah, right. No, I think that's fair. Yeah.
No, of course.
Another thing I stumbled across here, Patrick, that I just want to throw in the mix is Nevada, the state of Nevada, also a conservative state, passed a bill on Tuesday reducing restrictions on abortion, getting rid of a requirement that a doctor tell a pregnant patient about emotional implications of abortion, and removing criminal penalties for inducing abortion without the advice of a doctor. The distinction here is the Nevada legislature that passed this bill is majority women.
Interesting. That is surprising, actually. There is a legislature that is majority women.
The country's first majority women legislature.
Yeah, and I don't want to gloss over the fact that we are three white men talking about this, but, you know, sorry, I try. But actually, for this episode specifically, I didn't think abortion was going to be a huge deal, so I didn't try for this one. But anyway, you get my meaning. And I do want to mention, sorry, Gareth, go ahead.
Sorry, you're fine. No, I'm good.
It did spark conversations in France, at least, as well, because those questions are being raised in Europe also, questions about abortions and women's rights. And I think they are a lot less likely to become a reality in most of European countries. Some of them might act on them, a few, but even that I think is somewhat unlikely. But the question is being raised more and more. And I think that the way we approach it in France, the, you know, very non-religious people that we are, and even that is, we have a tradition of Christianity, but it's just we keep things separate, I think, a lot more than others do. I think the way we look at it is, I often, when we have Tony on the show, our friend from the US who is a pro-life American, we often go into the idea that if you think that life begins at conception, then it would make sense that you would want to protect it. And you see ending that life, an abortion, as killing a human being, which is some of the debate that comes up with the issue of Vincent Lambert, which we discussed earlier. Yeah. The way we look at it over, you know, in general, is that we mentioned that in the show before, it seems difficult to make the argument that the moment the egg is fertilized by the sperm, all of a sudden, that is a person. And similarly, it seems that, you know, at, let's say, 8 or 9 months, it's pretty clear that at that point, it's essentially a baby. So it's difficult to say when that happened, but the first few days, or maybe a couple of weeks or few weeks, let's say for us in France, it's 3 months where abortion is legal. Unless you have some outside system, in this case, in the case of many people, religion, that tells you this is when life begins, it's difficult to put a clear point on where it begins. And I think most people would agree at some point it begins, but certainly not in the first, you know, month or two. Because when you look at what's actually in there, it's a... Anyway, so you get my meaning. But that's the way we look at it. And of course, the considerations of women in general are very much in everyone's mind, and women's rights and reproductive rights and all of that. And that debate, I think, can't really be pushed further without having a woman present, so I won't venture in that direction. But that's essentially, I think, how we look at it.
Yeah, the last two conversations are very, very similar, aren't they? You know, we don't know enough about the human brain to know exactly what's going on in there. And I think until we're in a position where we do know more, it's incredibly difficult to say at what point that bundle of cells becomes a person. It's very difficult to say when that bundle of cells stops being a brain and when it starts just being another bundle of cells again. So it's a really, really difficult question to answer, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's always interesting to me that the debate around euthanasia, right to die, assisted suicide, is, even though it is controversial, is still less intense than the debate around the right to life, because it's about children, and we are just emotionally wired to be more protective and more intense around issues regarding children than we are around the end of our own lives, I think.
Well, I think there's that, but there's also the fact that it impacts the woman's life also, you know, that adds to the
controversy. Certainly, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that even more, well, maybe equally, as much as the fact that it's children makes it not controversial, but heats up passions.
Intense. Because,
Yeah, I think there's an assumption that when you're looking at, you know, the right to die and euthanasia kind of side of things, you're sort of making the assumption that the person has made that choice themselves already.
Right.
Whereas with abortion, no choice has been made by that individual. The choice is being made for them. And again, it's the same with the previous case. It's not clear whether he wants to be kept on life support or not. Mm. So that's why it becomes a bigger argument, because it's not clear whether it's his choice or not. And I think that's the issue.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We had a big conversation in the Slack for the show, which is accessible to the patrons. Feel free to become a patron if you enjoy the show at patreon.com/thefidiousclub, which involved adoption as well, which is, of course, a very big part of that conversation, because the people who are against abortion say, you know, we understand it's not easy. We're not saying, hey, it's going to be fine, just have a kid. But we should rely on adoption for those difficult situations, which, of course, is not the ideal situation because you still have to carry the baby and be separated. It's terrible. But, you know, if you're saving a life, I think that's a big part of the debate. And I'm not sure I'm, you know, qualified to discuss it, but that's also an argument that has weight, I think. What's...
Oh, sorry, I was just going to say, if it was clear that... you know, adoption systems or foster caring or, you know, the state looking after, the young people, if it was clear that that was a good thing and it was well done and that they would have a good experience regardless, then that might make it an easier decision.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second. No matter how bad their early years or maybe, you know, for some their life will be, is it better if they didn't live at all, right? If you're looking at it through the eyes of someone who believes this is... And regardless of when you think life begins, there's the potential for life in the fetus. And if you extinguish that potential, then that person that they might have become is not going to exist. And so, to make it clear, I'm very much pro-choice. But... I think this argument makes sense, The question is valid. Would that person, is it better if they didn't exist or if they were brought up in a system that is difficult, but that would allow them to live and make a life for themselves and contribute to society and everything?
Yeah, I don't necessarily think it doesn't answer the question, but it might make the question easier to answer.
Yeah,
I don't know. I feel I tend to bracket that off as, well, if we all decided that every pregnancy must be carried to full term, and I'm not suggesting that's what should or will happen, but if we all decided that, then we would tackle the problem of how do we make sure that children are taken care of, which we should already be tackling.
Yeah, that's the thing. So they're already not being taken care of properly.
I feel like it's tempting to want to focus on that part, that end, because that's a solvable problem, right? Even if we don't have an easy answer, we can all figure out how to better take care of children in the world. It keeps us away from the much thornier problem of when does life begin and all of that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm a scout leader and have been for several years, and part of the reason that I do that is because I know we get kids that come through scouting who get opportunities as a result who wouldn't otherwise. If the state were looking after them a little bit better, maybe we wouldn't need scouts. Maybe that's a bad thing. But, you know.
It's surprising that the people who are very much pro-life aren't voting for the states to increase spending in that area. I'm assuming maybe that's not the case. Maybe they're all.
No, I think the feeling there is that charities and churches particularly can do that if we get to that point where we can all focus on that.
We're already at
that's the belief anyway.
I think we're already at that point. I think you would, most people, maybe I'm wrong, but I would think most people would agree that the systems for care of orphans or, you know, children who don't have parents isn't adequate. You know, or maybe that's pop culture, you know, movies showing me kids being bounced around the system and having terrible experiences. Maybe it's not the case in reality, but that's my impression. And it's the same in France. So maybe we can strike a deal, pro-lifers and pro-choicers, and say, all right, let's first make that system, maybe not perfect, but very much improved, and give those kids who have been dealt a really bad hand something that we can all agree is a good hand, and then we can discuss abortions.
No, I don't think it's a then. I don't think it's an either or. How about we all agree to figure out how to take better care of children while we're also debating this other thing?
At the same time.
We could do two things at once, really.
I don't know, because if we're moving forward on no abortion, then we're throwing more kids to have a difficult life.
But it's a separate issue.
Yeah, it is. I understand.
I don't think we have to wait to work on one to work on the other. That's all.
No, yeah, but I feel like sidetracked us there.
No, but you're right. It is an important thing. But I feel like the reason I'm cheekily referring to the people who want this thing without this thing is that I feel the ideological anti-abortion stance would be sated, but then the issue that we already have and that we could be addressing that no one would argue against, well, I mean, in defense of the children who don't have parents, then that would not be necessarily a priority. The vehemence with which that abortion debate is being debated is nowhere as strong in the taking care, you know, the welfare, essentially. And I hate that that is a word that has become kind of a dirty word when I speak to an American audience, but the welfare system for kids, if it's not appropriate, I don't feel like the right, generally, I think that's fair to say, right-wing position that is pro-life would agree that we should increase government spending or whatever to better the welfare for orphans. Maybe that's me making an assumption, but
now you're going to have an argument that the government isn't the best entity to care for children. And that's fine. We can have a debate over what is the best way to create a system that cares better for children, especially children without parents. And I think if we had people working together to figure out that, they might understand each other a little better and be a little less vehement about the other issue.
Yeah, but it's not happening now, is my point.
Right.
It's not happening now.
I'm with you.
And I don't think that.
And it should.
Yeah, and it should. And it arguably should happen, well, maybe not arguably more than the one about abortion, but I don't think it would once the abortion discussion would be, quote unquote, settled into pro-life, right? I think that discussion would not happen more after that than it does now. I don't think people care. Some people do. And I'm sure some people, especially in the Christian community, are, you know, concerned with this. But I don't see that discussion, which would become a lot more necessary. And we're not even talking about the issues about women's health here. But the issue which would become even more necessary to discuss, I don't think it would be discussed more. But anyway, maybe I'm wrong. Feel free to let me know if you believe I am. All right. Last bit of conversation, which hopefully will be a little bit more lighthearted. And why don't you spark off the conversation? I've run out of puns.
Yes, let's clear the air, Patrick. Beverly Hills, California is not only about hillbillies and rich people. It's also about government regulation. The city was the first in California to ban smoking inside restaurants back in 1987. It banned smoking outdoors at outdoor venues in 2007. It has laws on the books already that say you cannot smoke inside of your condo or apartment because secondhand smoke can seep out into other areas, other parts of the building. And you can't smoke on the sidewalk in Beverly Hills. And now they have passed a bill to ban the sales of nicotine products. So not just cigarettes, but also vaping within the borders of Beverly Hills. This is a kind of a symbolic act, and will hurt Beverly Hills coffers because they you know won't have as many sales from their businesses inside the city, and you can easily drive less than a few blocks to Los Angeles and buy some cigarettes if you want, but they are banning the sale of any nicotine product within the city limits of Beverly Hills, except in three cigar clubs, one of which has Arnold Schwarzenegger as a founding member.
So wait, this is the city administration level, and they can do that on the city. It's not like Beverly Hills all of a sudden became its own state or something.
No, Beverly Hills, the city of Beverly Hills exists surrounded by Los Angeles, but it is separate from the city of Los Angeles. And so they can say, okay, within our city, you know, we have the right to govern what can and can't be sold within our city, and we're going to prohibit the sales of nicotine. Mm.
Yeah, you see, I'm happy to say that I'm a, you know, I'm an ex-smoker. I quit smoking, I don't know, 10 or 12 years ago, something like that. And I find it very, very frustrating in the UK where you have lots and lots of anti-smoking, you know, billboards and packets of cigarettes in this country have horrible, horrible photographs on them of people in, you know, serious medical trouble as a result of smoking. And I just sometimes think I wish the government would just say, do you know what, we're just going to ban it. We're just, it's this bad for you. We're saying that you've got to have all these photos and you know, you're not allowed to smoke in public places in the UK. If you're outdoors, you're okay. But if you're surrounded, you're not. I just wish they'd have the courage of their convictions and say, do you know what? No, it's bad for you. It's costing the NHS money. You know, there's a drain on the system. Yes, we get some money in from taxes. You know, I guess somebody could do the maths there and say, does it cost the NHS more than we make in taxes? I would assume it does. You know, let's do it. But that's an ex-smoker, and we are generally considered to be vehemently against smoking as a, you know, as an ex.
I think the issue there is that when you know, the US tried banning drinking for a little while, it didn't work out so well.
And alcohol is more damaging in some ways. Well, I think it's pretty bad, but yeah, they're pretty close. Let's put it that way.
Is it a short-term, long-term thing, though? I think with alcohol, it's easier to drink enough alcohol to do yourself damage and other people damage in the short term. It's difficult to smoke so much that you crash your car.
Right. It's more a long-term thing. But, I mean, it's debatable. What's certain is that smoking is pretty bad for you. I think the reason why countries aren't outright banning it is because it would create immediately, you know, illicit channels and a lot of, you know, dangerous situations. I think that's the reason.
One of the reasons is also an intensely powerful lobbying arm of the tobacco companies as well.
But that doesn't
make what you say untrue. There is the tax revenue, which is significant. Yeah, and the tax revenue. But if you make it illegal, people are addicted. They're going to go find a way to get tobacco, and then you create crime. You create an avenue for crime. Mm.
I think it's more than addiction. I think it's you need in society some measure of perversion, kind of ability to sin a little bit.
Not in Beverly Hills.
Not in Beverly Hills, right.
You are a famous person who's a member of the Grand Havana Room with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, sorry, I guess... I'm slightly hypocritical because I also look at things and I think, well, maybe we should relax the drug laws in the UK as well. So maybe on one hand, I think maybe it's either stop complaining about all the smokers or let's be more lenient generally. But I don't think, you know, doing both just seems completely ridiculous.
I think so. First of all, relaxing pot laws, yes, all for it. I'm all for that. But it seems a little, even to me, it seems a little bit extreme to prevent it everywhere. Like you need at least somewhere down the street, you have like a smoking corner. In Japan, they have a lot of those actually. You can't smoke anywhere you want, but you have like every few hundred meters, that's a few hundred feet for you. Americans, you have a smoking corner in the street and you have to go there if you want to smoke, stuff like that. So, yeah, but I mean, it's just Beverly Hills, but...
You can smoke inside your house if you own it in Beverly Hills.
What about in the garden?
You can smoke inside the three cigar clubs that they're giving an exception.
What about if you have a garden, can you smoke there and send the smoke
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know if that's allowed... I wonder if it depends on how big your garden is.
Put a roof on your garden.
It is Beverly Hills, after all.
Yeah, that's true. Because, I mean, it is going to be smelled. You smell it. In France, we had a smoking ban in most restaurants and coffee places a few years ago, maybe 15 years ago now. And you can still have a smoking section, and many of the coffee places do, but I was very surprised at how well it went. Everyone thought, oh, it's going to be terrible. Everyone's going to riot and they're going to want smoke to keep smoking, blah, blah, blah. And it went super well. Everyone was happy. And even the smokers were like, well, when I'm drinking my coffee or tea, I don't necessarily want to have the smoke smell if I'm not smoking myself. So everyone was happy. And it, you know, I often remember when I take a plane, I'm old enough to remember a time when people were allowed to smoke inside a plane.
And they had a smoking section as if the smoke didn't just fill the whole cabin. It was crazy.
It was like, it was terrible, terrible. even as an occasional smoker, very occasional, I can't understand how that was ever thought to be a good idea by anyone. So I don't know. I'm in the middle ground, I guess, from Beverly Hills.
Well, since we all put our credentials on the table, I quit smoking just about 19 years ago, June 27th, 2000.
You know the date. That's impressive.
Yeah, because it was the day I said when I turned 30, I'm going to stop smoking, and my birthday was the next day. So I was like, this is my last one.
Right. Oh, and was it like a thought out thing, or did you just...
It was. I had heard, when I was about 23, I had heard a radio news report about a study that found if you quit smoking by the time you're 30, that your lungs could recover more than 99% of their functionality. And I thought, great, I have 7 more years I can keep smoking because I was 23. But that like self-hypnotized me. So by the time I'm 30, I'm like, well, I've been telling myself I'll quit when I'm 30. So I got to.
Nice. Excellent. All right. Well, I guess that was a little bit, I don't want to say uplifting, but it did clear the air a little bit. So thank you for that, Tom. And that is going to be the end of our show for today. So before we leave, I'd like to remind everyone that you can support the show financially at patreon.com/thePhileas Club. Of course, the link is in the show notes. And if you enjoy what we do, please do consider sending a couple of bucks our way. It is very, very much appreciated. There are a few of you who already do it, and I love every one of you almost as much as I love my child. Almost. What if people want to hear more from you both? Where would they go, Tom?
Well, the best way to keep up with what I do is either go to tommerritt.com, or I can send you an email and just tell you every week. I send a nice little chatty email with links to all the shows that I do at freetomnewsletter.com. And it just comes in your inbox. Yeah, you can respond to it and ask me questions, and I'll respond right back. I've found it to be a very pleasant way to chat with people about the things I do. One of the things I'm doing this week and next week is filling in for Justin Robert Young on the Politics, Politics, Politics podcast, which is very exciting for me because I consider his show and this show to be two essentials in understanding the world around me. So if you want to check that out, that's at politicspoliticspolitics.com.
Yeah, I heard on DTNS you were doing that. I'm very excited to hear the always even-keeled and neutral Tom in that, I guess... Jury is
I was gonna say everybody says that, but Justin's show is actually pretty even-handed, so it's not like I'm gonna go off the rails, but I'm gonna talk politics,
right?
I talked about the president's temper tantrum yesterday when he just walked out of a meeting on infrastructure and immediately held a press conference in the Rose Garden. I talked about the Ukrainian president who was on a television show about being a president and is now the president and appointing all the people that helped him work on the television show to cabinet positions. It was really fun.
Oh, is he doing that? I didn't realize. I know he was elected.
He appointed a scriptwriter and two producers to his cabinet.
That is... anyway. that's the world we live in now. You know what? Maybe it's going to turn out fine. Who knows? Gareth, what about yourself?
Yeah, so nothing as grand as that. You know, I have a Twitter feed. I'm at Gareth Westwood. And I tweet very occasionally. But that's where best place to go.
Excellent. The link to your Twitter accounts will be in the show notes. For me, it's NotPatrick on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. NotPatrick in one word. And this show is at frenchspin.com. If you want to comment on what we said, please feel free to go in the comment section of the post for this episode. And I don't know when we'll be back. Hopefully with a special episode next week. But next month. But at some point next month, we'll be back. We'll see what happens. Thanks very much for listening. Don't forget about the Patreon. Do it now, because if you don't, you'll forget. And we'll talk to you in a few weeks. Bye.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.